Everyone can tell what it is, but how do you get it? With so many styles of music, with new gear coming out almost daily, what's the secret to great tone? Welcome to the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Radio Show, where we talk about tone, what it is, and how to get it. With your hosts, Jeff Floro and Scott Sill, we will talk to the creators of tone, the manufacturers, and the players as we explore tone and the gear that gets it. And now, here are your hosts, Jeff Floro and Scott Sill.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Radio Show. Hey, Scott, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing good, Mr. Jeff.
We had kind of a little, you've had a busy weekend. I went to one show, but you went to two shows this weekend.
Yeah, I did. I originally attended down in Long Beach. I went to the Musicians Expo hosted by Guitar Center and went to see what that was all about. Shot a few videos. Actually, already got them up on my YouTube page, which you can check out. A very cool demo of the MXR Talk Box, which I think is just a pretty cool little box.
Yes, that was kind of interesting. But you also had, which is actually getting a lot of hits, is that they had Blackie and the Stevie Ray Vaughan, what was the
name? Lenny.
Lenny.
So yeah, so it's, you know, those are two quite iconic guitars. The unique thing about, you know, well, Blackie's been on just about, you know, every major Eric Clapton hit that you can think of. But, you know, the cool thing about Lenny, the Stevie Ray Vaughan guitar, is that is the only guitar of Stevie Ray Vaughan's that has ever been sold on the auction. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I think they're still owned by his brother. So, So very, very cool, and it was great to see them, you know, kind of almost sad in some ways, but, you know, Blackie, no big deal. I mean, Eric sold that on his own, but Lenny, just kind of sad to see up there.
Yeah, no, that's true. And then we both went down to the L.A. Effects Pedal Show.
Yes.
And we want to thank Lonnie Spector. It was a great show. We saw a lot of interesting stuff. And we'll be posting some pictures and videos of some of the stuff that we saw.
Yes, and I think you will be the star of one of those videos.
Yes, that amp was great. It was fun playing it's made in... We're actually going to have him on the show. He's coming up on the show.
Yeah, Fullerton, California.
Yeah, so. From Fullerton. So anyway, we'll get all that information down. I'm still kind of absorbing it all. But
yeah,
anyway.
Yeah, and if you want to see those videos, just make sure to go on YouTube, and you can just search either by my name, Scott Sill, or you can find my YouTube channel, which is Selenium. So will be a very cool videos coming up.
Okay, let's get on with the show. We have a very special show here. A very good friend of mine, Lou Walker, we went to school together and studied music together. He resides in Colorado, a very interesting musician. He's kind of covered almost every type of style imaginable. He originally studied with a guy that you might know, Bob Weber. He was the guitarist for Sugarloaf. And I met him when we both were studying music at USC. He majored in USC there. He participated in a lot of master classes with Pepe Romero there. And over in Montana, when he was living over in Montana, I think you commuted to Montana. He participated, and it was one of the regular performing students for Christopher Parkening's master class. So pretty interesting. He also has competed internationally, and we'll talk about that in a minute, with classical competitions. And besides that, he plays in several different types of bands, some rock bands. He plays with the Colorado 101st Army Band. The Mile High Club, I think, is the name of them. And he's in two big bands, swings type of stuff, called Swing Inc. is one of the bands, and Serenade in Blue. So he's kind of a jack of all trades. And I just want to welcome. It's a pleasure to have you on. Hey,
well, thanks,
Lou.
Thanks so much, Jeff and Scott. It's just real pleasure to come out here. And it's always a treat to visit Los Angeles. Of course, I lived out here for many years. But Colorado's my home and grew up there, and it's always a refreshing break here, especially since they got quite a bit of snow coming in tonight, Colorado. So I hope they enjoy it out there when I'm out in sunny California.
Yeah, you must be enjoying the warmth because yes. It was pretty warm today. So anyway, listen, I'm going to kind of jump around a little bit here, but give us a brief synopsis of your background.
Sure.
I think it'll probably be easier for you because there's just a lot. There's a lot of stuff.
Well, you know, whatever I do because I love it. And for that is the only reason I tend to do something. And when I was young, studied some piano when I was about second grade, picked up the trumpet in about fourth grade. But about 12th grade, I guess 12 years old, rather, I picked up the guitar, took some lessons. My parents were a little mixed about me taking guitar because I was already playing trumpet in the band, but eventually the trumpet was still there, but the guitar became a little bit more my primary instrument. But it was interesting by the time I did pick up the guitar, since I had played other instruments, I knew how to read music, read treble clef, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was already kind of halfway there. My dad was pretty supportive. I don't know if he wanted me to become a professional musician, but he was able to find some good teachers, including Bob Weber, who was playing with a band called Sugarloaf. They had a number one hit, Green Eyed Lady, and sometimes mm-hmm. I'd have lessons with him during the week, and he would have to break and say, hey, no lesson this week, Lou, because, you know, I got to go on the road or got to go play with Jethro Tull, open up for them or whatever. I remember specifically that was one of the people that they toured with. Also, Johnny Smith, who's one of the great jazz guitarists. I never actually took lessons with him, but I used to go down to Johnny Smith Music when my dad took me on the road. He was in sales, and so on the summer, I wasn't in school, so I'd travel around the state with him, and no trip to Colorado Springs was, you know, complete without stopping by Johnny Smith Music. I was a little pesky kid, but I always brought some music from him, and of course, he's about 90 years old. I still understand he's alive and well, one of the great jazz guitarists, and, you know, he, interesting background, but would give me points and tips on various
things.
Yeah,
he's interesting. You might not know this, Scott, but he wrote Walk, Don't Run, which was a big hit with Chet Atkins and a big hit with The Ventures. I mean,
yes.
It's a classic surf song.
Right.
He was the guy that wrote that.
Right. Originally kind of a da-da-da-da-da, just kind of a light swing thing. And then Chet countrified it. The Ventures heard it and made surf rock.
The rest is history.
Yes.
So, yes, and we're going to be talking about him in a little bit when we start talking about transcriptions.
Sure. And then had the opportunity to come out here to California, studied music, had a degree in music. A little bit of classical, a little bit of popular music studies, and graduated, went to the Air Force, but originally not in music, had a chance to become an officer, and did the music on the side, but did something else in the Air Force, and then after about a 3 or 4 year break, I went to law school. Oh my gosh, do I bring that in? Maybe I might not. The listening public just went down. So did that and did music on the side. I participated in some guitar competitions. I did have a chance to go to Bozeman just about every summer.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Christopher Parkening kind of, in fact, there's a book he wrote called, I haven't had a chance to read it, but Grace Like a River. And he talks about how he kind of left Southern California, moved to Bozeman, gave up the guitar for a few years, and about his only involvement in the guitar for several years was really teaching some master classes at Montana State in Bozeman. And I used to go up there. And it was a week-long class. It was at the end of February, and it just went until about 3 years ago. And I you know, Christopher's kind of walked away from the concert stage at this point and focusing on teaching. After many, many decades.
Yeah.
Whether there will be a reunion masterclass, I don't know. He's teaching over at Pepperdine now, but also had the opportunity to participate in some masterclasses with Pepe Romero.
Yeah, you also participated in, I think, in Mexico, the mm-hmm. Cuernavaca Classical
right.
Guitar Festival?
Right. My good friend Manuel Rubio is one of the better classical guitarists in Mexico, and it's not going on right now, but he did organize the Cuernavaca, Mexico Classical Guitar Festival. There was no competition in that, but and I think Manuel sort of did that about the early 90s, and it went until just a few years ago. He kind of left Cuernavaca and is teaching over at Merida, Mexico
mm-hmm.
now. But, you know, it was a great program. He had wonderful players and luthiers from all over Mexico, master classes, just about everything, but there wasn't a competition. But I had a chance to play there a couple of times at his request and enjoyed that very much. And some festivals do have competitions as part of them, like the GFA, Guitar Foundation, or Federation of American Foundation of America, has an annual guitar competition, one of the big ones.
Yeah, I remember you telling me when you were going to Europe, you went to the Printemps de la Guitare
right.
in Concours. I think I'm pronouncing that right. My French is bad. In Concours, Belgium, right?
Yes, it is. I think one of the better guitar competitions. It goes every 2 years. It tends to be I think in every even year, around maybe November, it goes for a week in Belgium. Very well organized. It was started by some members, I believe, of the Kiwanis Club, I believe, over there, who were guitar enthusiasts. And I was in the second competition in 1990. A lot of these competitions have age cutoffs. Not all of them, but you know, just some people think, well, why have a guitar competition? And I think that's a valid question. You know, we had Van Cliburn, who just passed away, and of course, one of the things he's known for is the Tchaikovsky competition in, you know, 1955, at the height of the Cold War. And of course, the piano world may be a little different, where I'm told that if you really want to be a concert classical pianist, it helps to win a major competition when you're young. But I don't know if that's necessarily the case in the guitar world. But we do have several competitions. The GFA is one of them, and I think that there's a website for the GFA, and it makes reference to that. And also, Christopher Parkening started just a few years ago an international competition over at Pepperdine, and I think they just, that's every 3 years, and I think they just had their second iteration of that competition.
Well, it's a different kind of gig, but I think it's good because it gets people to play, and you don't get that opportunity all the time to get to hear good classical guitar playing.
Yes. Well, so I think that those are probably some of the major ones. I think that there is one in Spain that is, it's called the Segovia competition, and that's, of course, really popular. One of the great competitions when I was a kid was in Toronto, Canada, but I think that that no longer exists, but I think Leona Boyd had won that competition, and it was also, again, maybe every 2 or 3 years. But when I played in Belgium, one reason that I was interested in that particular one is because it just fit my schedule. I was kind of working as a deputy DA out in the Midwest, and it just fit a time where I could go out there. But essentially, they asked for a packet. They wanted to know who I had studied with, and there were several required pieces, including a guitar concerto, and they sent it in on. They said that I was accepted. But it did not require a tape, but it did require some background information. So whether or not there were some people who tried to get in and didn't, I don't really know. But I applied. There were only two guitarists from the U.S. who were there.
So they needed to know that you could play a certain piece?
Yes, several pieces.
Okay.
And they said that one was the Casanova Tedesco Capriccio Diabolico, which is a really tough piece. And also you had to be able to play at least one of the six guitar concertos, all tough pieces. And so they had a lot of questions on the application on who I'd studied with and, you know, if I'd been in other competitions. So, but I do know that there are some competitions where you actually have to have a tape or maybe an endorsement from a teacher.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
All right.
There are some, I think in the Parkening competition, I believe you have to go through some rounds. And the ones that the public actually sees is a later phase of those. And when I went to Belgium, there were three phases. There were about 100 players who showed up. This is 1990. It was a wonderful experience. Belgium's a wonderful country, and I had an opportunity to meet John Paul McClellan, who was taught out in Kansas City. Just the two of us were from the U.S. And we all played all 100. It was spread off over about 4 or 5 days. We were required to play a piece by Fernando Sor, one of his variations, two of the Villa-Lobos etudes, and then a free piece. So I played all those, and at the end of 4 days, 16 people went forward, and I was not one of them.
at least that the competition, at least you moved up, you got there. But the thing is, everybody had to play these specific pieces, and then you had your own.
Yes, most of the competition, for instance, in the second phase, they had to play the Casanova Tedesco piece, which was really tough, and then also they had a piece specifically composed for that competition by a Belgian composer, a specific beautiful piece for classical guitar.
How long did it take you to prep for that?
You know, it was months, Jeff. I will say that I probably prepped 5 to 6 months for that.
Wow.
And my playing, I was trying to play 5 hours a day. I didn't, but I did log my playing, and I would try to play. I'd play a couple hours before work. My apartment was right by where I worked, so I ran home over the noon hour, got an hour in, and then right before, maybe an hour before dinner, an hour after dinner. And I would do that, but then I'd miss a day. Maybe Sunday it would come up and something would happen, and I'd just blow off a day. So actually, I would say, in reality, it was about close to 4 hours a day I logged, even though I shot for five. And most of what I was doing was just the music. You don't want to spend a whole lot of time on technique when you're getting in a competition. In fact, there's a great movie called The Competition. Dreyfuss is in it, and I think Amy Irving is in it, and it's about a piano competition. And I think one of the teachers tells this competitor, nothing matters but the music.
Yeah, I can see that.
But
go ahead.
Yeah, so Luke, can I put you on the spot and actually have you grab your classical and let's play us something.
Sure, I'd love to. Here's a piece from Mexico. It's called The Prayer. It is anonymous. I believe there's some different arrangements of it.
Well, you can't see it on the show, but it's interesting. While he was playing, and we shot a video of this piece that we're going to post. Scott's going to post it on his Selenium YouTube page. But just kind of go through a little bit. You were moving your hand up and down around the sound hole as you were playing, so you're getting a thinner, treblier sound and a deeper sound.
Right.
Can you give a little bit of an example of what you're doing with your nails?
Well,
he has really good nails.
For instance, one way to vary the tone and the timbre of the guitar is getting closer to the getting closer to the bridge. You're right in the sound hole here, but as I turn close to the bridge, it gets a brighter sound. And this is a fatter sound. And also another thing is when you pull maybe up as opposed to maybe going vertically, as opposed to more of a horizontal, if you pull up, it gives more of a kind of a harpsichord.
Yeah.
You know, if I was playing, if I wanted more of a harpsichord sound, I'd pull up. And then also the angle you hit the strings, if you hit it straight on with your fingers, opposed to maybe a little bit more of an angle. And I think those three things, sometimes a combination of those is what makes a difference. And it's the same with the thumb. And if you're close to the bridge, it's a little higher. And to a certain extent also, your fingering on your left hand. if I play this piece, if I were to use it in a first position, as opposed to a higher position, a little fatter.
Well, that's fatter because you're also changing strings.
Right, right.
Yeah. Now, are you using, I'm going to go back to our school days when we were studying under Duke Miller, do you hammer when you pluck the string at the same time? Are you hammering your on the fret when you play to get more clarity? Because I know on electric,
right.
It really helps for...
Right. You know, you try to do it simultaneously as far as...
Yeah, you're hammering, yeah.
Sure.
His hands are curled on the fretboard, mm-hmm. and when he strikes it with his finger, he's hammering on the string, mm-hmm. and it's a little trick, especially on electric guitar. When you do that, it gets more... You mm-hmm. articulate more, and when you play fast notes, it sounds cleaner.
Right.
Can you give me a run or something, a scale?
Oh.
So every time he's plucking the note, he's actually, mm-hmm. the finger that's on the fretboard is hitting the string down. Yeah, you're hammering on. Though.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, do you ever use your pinky with your right hand?
Not so much. That one usually doesn't play, although the exception would be sometimes the Spanish flamenco style, the rasgueado. That's about it. Sometimes you kind of shoots out all four fingers. You kind of have to pack them and hopefully get them even.
Yeah, if I'm correct, there's not that much classical music that actually uses
no,
the pinky.
No, almost none. Just that one, perhaps that one.
Now, is there a certain type of method you're using with your right hand? Like, is there different ways to use your right hand?
Sure. Well, you know, there is also the some players. Most of us play off kind of the right side, but every once in a while, somebody plays more off the left side. Like Ida Presti was a real famous.
What he means
guitar.
By the left side is
yeah.
he's playing off of his index finger.
Yeah.
Being the left for him. If you were looking down at the guitar,
mm-hmm.
it would be the left. And then what he means by the right side, it's towards the pinky
yeah.
or your ring finger.
Right. And I don't know that one is better than the other. Every once in a while, I'll play off the right. You know,
well, when I was watching you play, you're
mm-hmm,
shifting. So
mm-hmm.
sometimes you're hitting it with your nail at an angle, and then other times you're hitting it square.
Right.
On.
Yeah, exactly. And but also when you're trying to get a little bit more volume on the guitar, I may reposition. It's sort of like taking the lid off a jar. You kind of go from your normal position a little bit to the right, and
right.
just a little bit more volume. But one of the challenges in classical guitar is to, when you do want some volume, to make it loud without making it harsh. Because so often a classical guitarist will try to be loud, and then instead of getting a fuller sound, they'll get more of a harsh sound when they go to a maximum.
Yeah. It can shatter.
Yes, yes. And part of that, I think, also is just moving the hands a little bit to the right. I remember Julian Bream once said that most of the time he plays about 90% of the instrument's volume. And every once in a while, he'll go up to 100%. And that's probably... we try to achieve a classical sound that is full, round. I think one thing also when you talk about various types of guitar is we tend to like guitars that have maybe a darker, lower register, maybe almost more like a cello type of a...
But now, would you account that to the wood? I mean, I assume that's probably because the rosewood in that guitar.
I think so. You know,
looks like it has a cedar top too.
Yeah, right? It does have a cedar top and it has Indian rosewood. This is a Ramirez made in the
1997. Mm-hmm. I wrote it down. I looked
yes.
in there. It's an R2.
Yeah.
Just so everybody knows.
And well, one thing I'd say about guitars is I spent a lot of time before I picked this one out, and I went with a friend as well, another classical guitarist in Denver. We went all over. And we particularly like this one, even though there were a couple others that were actually a little pricier. And it's interesting when classical guitars are made. I mean, you can have a guitar maker who uses the same glue and the same wood and the same everything, and one of his guitars from that batch will be good, but the next one will be fantastic. And sometimes we just don't know why that is. Another thing, this guitar I've had, you know, for over a decade, but sometimes when the guitar is new, they kind of tend to be a little brighter. Sometimes they talk about being tight. And I think that that's just the lacquer and so forth. It takes a while to loosen it up.
Right, it's like a steel string. It has to be broken in.
Yeah.
So Lou, we did have a question on our chat room for you, asking, and actually before I go to that, I just want to remind everyone that you can call 323-203-0815 if you have a question for Lou. You can be on air with us. So the number is 323-203-0815, and feel free to call at any point. And if we can take the call, we will. The question from the chat room is from Squeetones, and they're wondering, have you noticed any resurgence in classical guitar in the last few years? Would it possibly have something to do with, and my wife is probably going to be shaking her head after I say this, but Rodrigo E. Gabriella. I'm terrible at
I love that duo. It's just a really neat group, and heard of them a couple of years ago, and have a couple of their recordings. It could well be. I know that Christopher Parkening was talking to our class one year, and he was talking about in the 60s there really weren't that many guitarists around, and into the 70s guitar really had a great resurgence. But then into the 80s and 90s it kind of waned a little bit. The audiences were not quite as big. I'm not sure why that was, and exactly what's going on now, I don't know. I think it seems like most of the major labels have their classical guitarist. It is kind of hard to get a classical guitar recording contract, but that could well be. I mean, I love that duet of...
A lot of people don't realize, though, actually when it waned in the U.S., but actually, even in the 90s, in the 80s and 90s, classical guitar globally was a bigger phenomenon than electric guitar. I know that's kind of hard to understand or comprehend, because being in the United States and being a rock player too, I'm inundated with, you know, you're thinking all of that. But it's actually internationally that's played more than electric.
Yes. I don't know where I heard this statistic, but I've heard every other home in Japan has a classical guitar. I don't know if that's true or not.
Well, one of the places that was really big was China.
Mm. Well, there's some great players from China. Even when I was in Belgium, we had a couple who showed up, and they're great players. I also think that maybe some of the emerging nations in sometimes you find guitar where you don't expect it. I think it's interesting to find. And that's one thing that I think can bring you together. I may travel in Mexico or wherever with a guitar, and sometimes another player will see me, or somebody who's maybe kind of just an enthusiast, and we strike up a conversation. It's just sort of one of those icebreakers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one thing also too, with in talking about the tone and the sound, the differences that I've seen, like a friend of mine has a very expensive Mattingly guitar, and I have a classical, but it's not a very expensive one, but it gets a good recording tone. You got to play with it a little bit to get it to work, but the more expensive guitars, they sustain more and they ring. And one thing that's very difficult and shows a true classical player that knows his stuff is to bring those inner voices out, especially where you're doing counterpunnel stuff.
Mm.
And a good guitar, it's a little easier because it's balanced a little more, and those middle strings ring true, and it just rings. I mean, the Mattingly, I would just hold it and it would just sustain for like 5 seconds. Mm. It was amazing.
Yes, I met Bob Mattingly when I was living in the Midwest. He came out and put on a workshop about guitar building, and along with another player, John Sutherland, who's sometimes up at Bozeman. He's an assistant to Chris Parkening, teaches in Georgia. And I've played his guitars, and they are remarkable instruments. I think Bob Mattingly really had a real talent, one of the great player, one of the guitar makers. And, of course, he was down in, was it Long Beach where he was?
Yeah, he was he was a local person, but his guitars are pretty famous.
So let me ask you this question, kind of restructuring a question that we actually have on the chat room. If money wasn't an object, what guitar brand would you go with? And if money was an object, you know, what's the affordable classic guitar that you think is not too shabby?
Mm. Well, that's a great question. I think, of course, Ramirez is a great instrument. Some of the best are from the 1960s, though, and they're a little hard to find. I think sometimes they're a little overpriced, and I have a friend who has two, and I occasionally use one or two of them. They're wonderful instruments. However, I think that there's some really good ones. Mattingly's are wonderful instruments. I think also there's some good ones being made in Mexico down in Paracho.
Now these are the ones you would say money's no object.
Well, I would say Paracho. There's a Garcia guitar that's being made down there, for instance. That's pretty good. That's not outrageously expensive. I've just played it, and you know, Paracho is a town in Mexico where a lot of Mexican guitars are made, and a lot of them are kind of cheap import kind of. But there are a handful of really fine guitar makers too in Paracho, and there's actually a guitar festival every year there. I've never been to it, but
so what? I mean, acoustic guitars can get pretty crazy. What are you talking like? Well, as in what would be an expensive one versus? I mean, obviously an affordable one would be $200-$300, $400
well,
guitar.
Well, Humphrey makes a pretty tough to find guitar. Part of it's the design is a little different on a Humphrey. I think Sharon Isbin and Elliot Fisk both play them, and the fretboard is a little higher off the body, and it produces a little more punchy sound, I think, among other things. And those are very hard to come by. The Humphrey, expensive. But you know, I'll tell you, I've played some really nice Takaminis that have not been that high.
You like the Yamahas? And we're talking about intermediate.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because those are a good guitar for a couple $100.
Yes, they are. My first guitar was a Yamaha. It was a student model. Although there was a time when Yamaha did make a high-end model. I don't know if they still do or not. They kind of had the logo up at the top was engraved in wood.
I think they make custom ones. But you were at the Mattingly that my friend has. Now that, I don't know if he still makes anymore, Mattingly makes anymore, but the his guitar is about $10,000.
That's what I was wondering, if that's
right,
where they go.
Right. The older ones are more valuable, but they'll custom build you some stuff. I think Ramirez still makes some high-end ones,
yes,
and those are about $5,000 or $6,000, right?
Yes. Although, I think you can have a really good classical guitar without busting the bank. Search around. It's going to take some time. You know, don't take out a loan for a guitar is all I can say. And the other thing is there's a question on how long a guitar is going to last. I mean, some people think a guitar suggests maybe 50 years. Well, if you buy a really outstanding Ramirez from the early 60s, well, maybe it's only got another 10 years of good life, and maybe you'd be better off getting a more contemporary instrument that might have a might not peak out.
And there's we saw some stuff at NAMM. I was walking around with Jean-Pierre Durand from Incendio. And there's a couple of guys that were making guitars with spruce tops, which is not common for a classical guitar, and using exotic woods. And they were sounding really, really interesting. So there's been some experimentation in classical guitar now. You're going to see some other, because now, especially since rosewood is such a rare wood, they're now having to get creative and try other things.
Right. Well, so. I have a Lorenzi also. It was from 1967, I found, and it has a Brazilian rosewood. And, of course, that's prohibited to be used internationally. I think that there's some treaties and so forth because of the rainforest.
What was the one that Duke used? He had a real rare one, an old one.
Yes.
Was it a Mauser?
Hauser.
Hauser.
And, yeah, Duke Miller had a Hauser, and those are also very expensive.
Very expensive now because they don't make them anymore.
Also, Fleta, or F-L-E-T-A, and John Williams has one of those. Again, they're difficult to find. I played a Fleta once. I played a Bernabe, but you have some outstanding ones, and then you have others. I think Segovia had a Ramirez that's in the Prado Museum, and Christopher brought it to our master class one year. He recorded that tribute to the Segovia album with it.
That's cool.
Luke.
Sure.
So since you mentioned Brazilian woods, before we go, I think we're going to take a break here pretty soon, and then we'll have you play something on your jazz guitar. I just thought I'd ask, so since you had gone out of country with quite a bit of classical, and I think you even mentioned you have one that has Brazilian in it, did you ever have any problems bringing it back in, or is that more of a recent thing?
No, I haven't, but I do know one guitarist who told me that they have some kind of a certificate from the, I want to say the U.S. Department of Agriculture or something, that said that particular instrument was made at a certain time, and they keep it with their guitar so that if there's an issue at customs, they have that certificate. And that was Muriel Anderson who told me that. She travels with the Brazilian.
Yeah, I think that's recent, within the last 5 or 10 years at the most. But I don't remember anybody traveling. I don't think when you went to Belgium, that was even an issue.
No, I don't think so. And you know, I've had people look at my guitars in airports, but I think they're looking for other things. You know,
that's more, nah.
In today's world,
looking for items inside.
Yeah, I think they're a little more concerned about it. Yeah.
Okay, we're gonna take a break, and Lou's gonna grab his jazz guitar. He has a beautiful Guild X500 here, and we're gonna talk about big band music, and then also talk about really important transcriptions. So hang on, we'll be right back after this.
You are listening to the most original talk radio station anywhere. We are LA Talk Radio at latalkradio.com.
The Flow here. You're listening to the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Radio Show on latalkradio.com.
Scott here from the Flow Guitar Enthusiast, and I have an exciting contest to tell you about. We will be giving away a Big Muff Pie with the Tone Wicker option on April 29th when the legendary Mike Matthews and the good folks from Electroharmonics are our guests. This pedal is autographed by Mike Matthews and sounds killer. To be a winner, like our Facebook page and visit our website, www.flowguitarenthusiast.com, and leave a comment on this contest story. Make sure to tune in Monday, April 29th to see if you're the winner. Take it away, Mike.
Rock and roll!
We are back, and we have Lou Walker, classic guitar player, rock player, jazz player, big band player, you name it, he plays it. Okay, he's got his jazz guitar on here. I just want to talk a little bit, just give us a little rundown what the difference is playing big band as opposed to doing like a rock gig.
Sure. Well, big band music, I play in two groups. One is called Swing Incorporated, five trumpets, five trombones, five saxes, and a full rhythm section, guitar, bass, drums, keyboards. And when you're playing with a group that big, you just kind of want to blend in. You're part of the rhythm section. Every once in a while, they let you take a solo. But you just want to fit in and not get in the way of the other players, particularly the keyboard player, harmonically. But so much of the music, like the Count Basie music, it's four to the bar, one, two, three, four. And one of the great guitarists was named Freddie Green, S-F-R-E-D-I-E.
Yeah.
Not with an I, but an I-E. And Freddie played with the Count Basie Orchestra from the 1930s until the late 80s. He was known as Father Time, and that rhythm section was sometimes referred to as the All-American Rhythm Section. And in a way, he not only was the center of that rhythm section, but also the Count Basie band. And you can get on YouTube and look at him playing. He played an unamplified archtop guitar with a microphone, and he could just whip out all kinds of rhythms and voicings. Very interesting player. Rarely played a solo. Every once in a while he'd play maybe a little bit, but he was almost strictly a rhythm guitarist.
Now the function of the guitar in big band, it's a different function.
Yes.
Than rock, right?
Right. It's you know, the horns or the singer is what is featured rather than the guitar or the rhythm. Every once in a while you can play a solo, but not so much. And so much of the music is just, you know, one, two, three, four, but
so you're functioning more as the timekeeper.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in rock,
right,
the drum is the timekeeper.
Yes. Exactly. And also with big band music, it's been said that it's better to be felt rather than heard. And that's a little difficult to explain, but you want kind of a dry sound rather, I think the expression in classical music would be secco, you know, a drier sound rather than a full jazz sound. You know, not so much a sound like this, but more of a... And especially in Freddie Green's playing, it's light, heavy, light, heavy. In other words, Freddie Green didn't play just like... He would be light, heavy, heavy on the second.
The,
yes.
Right.
And almost always... Now, it would depend also on the piece. Some of the pieces would lend itself to maybe a little different. And you'd back out a little bit, and then when a soloist would be playing, you might actually do more of a comping, which instead of maybe four to the bar, would be more like, if you were playing a piece that was had this kind of a progression, you might do, or you might go in and out. The main thing is just not to step on the pianist's toes, so to speak. And one thing about the Count Basie band is that Count Basie, even though he's a real fine pianist, tended to play very sparingly here and there. Same with Duke Ellington. He tended not to really monopolize the harmony, and it would just be in there. But especially, and that would really open Freddie Green up to be more.
How would you describe what is comping? I know a lot of people don't know that.
Well, comping is where the accompanying instrument maybe breaks away from a strict 1-2-3-4 rhythm and maybe accentuates a little bit. And it's often done during a solo. And you might, instead of hitting 1-2-3-4, you might do 1-2-3, maybe have the 4 silent and then maybe hit the rhythm. Or you might just hit maybe just and go kind of in and out. And maybe kind of create your own groove.
Because usually a lot of guys, I know the piano players do it, but I hear guitar players do it too, where they would like syncopate. And go, they would like they would do like a counter rhythm, like blum, blum, blum. They'd push the beat or go behind the beat and accent, do like little accents.
Right. And it would also depend upon the soloist. If the soloist is really out there, all over the place, out there rhythmically, I think if you get out there too rhythmically, it doesn't blend as well, as opposed to some situation where you have a soloist who's maybe playing more on the beat, more closer to the original melody, and so you're maybe able to do a little bit more syncopation. Also, a lot of times I will maybe slide into the first beat, even, you know, like I will do that, but I'll try to be pretty consistent, you know, a little bit, not too much. It can get a little annoying when you're sliding around a lot, but I do that sometimes.
Would you mind giving us a quick 1 minute or 2 minute piece?
Oh, sure.
And then when we come back, we can, or after that, then talk about transcriptions.
Sure, yes. I'll do, speaking of Duke Ellington, I'll play a little Satin Doll, one of his classics.
Brings us to transcriptions. So you've played a lot of transcriptions, and you've used those in the when you've competed too, right?
Right. Yes. Absolutely. Well, I mean, on the classical world, Bach, for instance, J.S. Bach, he did write some pieces for the lute, but most of what we play on the guitar is maybe keyboard transcriptions or vocal transcriptions, and you know, like Yesu Joy of Man's Desiring, that was a very popular piece that Christopher Parkin recorded. It was arranged by Frank Foster for the classical guitar, and that was published, I believe, maybe Sherry Brenner, maybe it's published nowadays by Hal Leonard. A lot of that is published through Hal Leonard. And Segovia transcribed a lot of things too, you know, the Bach Chaconne violin piece from the Partita is a very famous work, and Segovia did his transcription. There have been a couple others as well. And then on the popular world, I do use some transcriptions of pieces. Sometimes I've taken them off the off like Johnny Smith's recordings and so forth. However, I tell you, Wolf Marshall is a real fine guitarist and has transcribed a lot of solos and pieces by some real famous jazz guitarists. I think that's Hal Leonard.
Yeah, well, Johnny Smith was the person where I guess where they coined the phrase chord melody.
Yes.
Can you just give a little chord melody demo so people understand what that is?
Sure. I'll play Michelle, and this is a Chet Atkins arrangement.
basically what he's doing is he's taking the melodies on top, mm-hmm. and then he comps or throws a little chord thing below it. But there's actually transcriptions of these stuff.
Right.
And Johnny Smith was probably the most famous for that.
Yes, and that transcription I got from I don't remember the poster, it was called Chet Atkins Picks on the Beatles. And it was actually in a whole album of Beatles things he did during their heyday. And there was a book that was published, and I still use it. A lot of times I'll play dinner music. I'm in the National Guard Band, as you mentioned, and often I'll play like at the Governor's Mansion for dignitaries and so forth. They like a little background music, and I'll play some light things like Michelle and Yesterday and some things people recognize just with the guitar. And sometimes I'll use classical. Usually I'll use this guitar.
No, I was just going to say, since we mentioned Chet Atkins, I thought, what the heck? I'll toss in, so I've got some wonderful Taylor shirt and hat and some picks. And the first person, if someone can call and answer the question, what guitar company created a stereo guitar that was specifically made for Chet Atkins playing? And what was unique about it compared to other stereo guitars?
Okay, I don't even know that answer. That's going to be an interesting one.
You need to call in. Sorry, call in 323-203-0815, 323-203-0815.
Or can they, if they're in the chat room?
If they're in the chat room, they can provide the answer.
Now, what I want to, I don't know the answer. You're going to have to judge it. It actually stumped me on that one. But anyway, what I wanted to ask real quick is, where do you go to get transcriptions now?
Sure. Well, I think you can get them on Amazon. I think I've seen the Christopher Parkening's transcription on Hal Leonard, and I think just about everything he's recorded.
So Hal Leonard's a big publisher of transcriptions.
Yes, huge. And Mel Bay, you get some on Mel Bay as well. And a lot of times I'll just go to the local music shop and see what's available.
Mm-hmm.
And then some friends and so forth. But I'll tell you another one that I really enjoyed. I'm not sure the publisher on this, but Leona Boyd did a set of Christmas pieces that I play often. Called A Guitar for Christmas. And anytime I have a chance to play holiday music, and I often do, I'll use that book. It's really good. All kinds of just traditional Christmas pieces. And a lot, for instance, every year we have a Christmas event, a seasonal event, I should say, at the Governor's Mansion for families of deployed troops. And I play the guitar and, you know, get little kids to sing along with me and so forth.
That's cool.
Whose parents or mother or father are deployed, and you know, you get them singing Jingle Bells or whatever, but also I play like Green Sleeves and so forth like that, and there's some really good arrangements in that particular book.
Oh, that's cool. Now, where do you go to get the Johnny Smith stuff?
Well, Johnny Smith, I know Hal Leonard has his, so there's a book of solos, and that just came out, I think, in the last year or so. It's all his solos, you know, single note things. It is hard to find his arrangements. I think Guitar Player, if you, like in the Denver Public Library, we have all the old Guitar Player magazines back into the 60s. And Johnny Smith was on the board, I think the board of directors or board of editors of Guitar Player magazine. And occasionally, it seemed like about every year, they would put one of his arrangements in. And
Who publishes the Chet Atkins one? Is that published? The Picks on the Beatles?
I think that's Baldwin, but I'm not sure. But I have a feeling that's out of print. That may be a little hard to find.
Right.
You know, sometimes you buy a book and you may only use the one arrangement, but that's usually well worth it if you can even find one piece that's part of your repertoire. And I try to memorize things, but it's always a good idea when you're playing a solo guitar gig to try to get a little book together in a binder form, because sometimes it's hard to remember all that stuff, whether it's classical or whether it's more of a pop thing. And plus, sometimes you never know what's going to go over.
Yeah, now, and George Smith, I think they still have his method.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because if you get like what they call a fake book,
mm-hmm.
You can find some of that. You can learn how to do the chord melody. Hold on, we got a caller here. I'm going to answer this. Welcome to the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Radio Show. Could I have your name and where you're calling from?
Hey, what's going on, man? It's Frank over at Squeak Jones in El Paso, Texas.
Hey, Frank. Thanks for calling. Do you have a question for
Lou? Absolutely. I didn't necessarily want to win, but I was curious. I think I know the answer. I just wanted to see if I was right or not.
Go for it.
Okay. So at the shop, just not too long ago, we sold a Gibson GAR-79. I'm guessing it was Gibson because that amp had a stereo input. And my understanding is that amp was sold as a kit with a ES-335 that had a stereo output. So am I right?
Since we are running out of time, I can probably give the answer away. You are not correct, unfortunately.
Dang it.
It would be Gretsch guitars, and what was unique about the stereo guitar was the Gibson model, right, is the neck pickup and the bridge pickup are separated in stereo. The way they did it to match his playing was the bottom three strings are one left side, and then the top three strings are right side, and they split it out stereo that way. Not very popular. They didn't make a lot of guitars, and actually, if you find, I think it's a White Falcon stereo as a, they're worth a lot of money.
And also, too, you had Frank. You had mentioned you asked a question that you had at your store, Jasmines and Samix.
Yeah,
you were asking
absolutely.
About those classicals, and I think Lou will agree with me. When you're dealing with more economical guitars, the key there, I think, is you got to try them, and there's some great ones. I mean, my guitar, my classical that I got when I started at school was like a couple hundred bucks, and I went through about seven or eight of them, and I just liked that one, and I picked that one, and it's fine. So you just have the problem with the problem with the cheaper guitars is not the quality of the guitar. I think they are different. So you just got to kind of sift through them and pick them up. And then also, too, Frank, can you give us your website for your store? Let everybody know about
you. Yeah, absolutely. It's under the same name. We're at www.squeetoneguitars, S-Q-U-E-E-T-O-N-E-S, guitars.com. And, of course, we're on Facebook and Twitter as well.
All right, everybody follow them and check out their webpage, too. Good people.
Thanks for calling, Frank.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks all so much.
All right, bye-bye. Yeah. So anyway, to wrap up, because we're almost out of time, what I was going to ask you about was there was a method from Johnny Smith had a method how to do the chord melody.
Yes.
Is that still out?
That's hard to find. I've seen it on eBay. And it's in bass clef, interestingly, which is a little different. But it's the Johnny Smith method or technique. I think it's Johnny Smith method. And it's well worth the time. It's a little different approach. But also, the other thing I want to say about my military music, I'm a bandsman, Colorado Army National Guard. And, you know, originally I was thinking of becoming a weekend warrior as a JAG officer, judge advocate, and there was an opening in the band for a guitarist, and I took it, and that was many, many years ago. I'm still in. And as far as maybe some younger players out there who might be interested, you might want to talk to your recruiter. That's up to you. It's not for everybody, because to become a member, even as a weekend warrior, you do have to go to basic training and so forth. But it is a lot of fun.
Mention really quick, too, because I didn't know about this, about the Army school?
The Armed Forces School of Music is in Little Creek, Virginia, at the Little Creek Amphibious Naval Base. Same place that the SEALs train, and I think all the branches except the Air Force are involved there. And, you know, if you get in the military, they will send you there for a while to learn some military style and marching band, all that good stuff.
Great. Well, thanks, Lou, for having you coming on. We enjoyed your playing. Fantastic, as always. Definitely want to mention that next week we have Rick Skillman, the artist relations and product specialist from Celestion Speakers. It'll be a fantastic show. Coming up also, Denny Tedesco, producer and director of the Working Crew film. So it'll be a great show. It's coming up.
Good night, everybody.